superintendent run public housing. And the project she lives in was just like the one they blew up, the Pruitt Igoe. It was just like that. She grew up there. Now, it's incredibly beautiful. I mean, there's flowers and there's grass and it's been, everything's been redesigned in communication with tenants about mothers needing to be able to look out their window and see the playground, all kinds of things. People every week have an assignment about when they sweep their hallway. And the tenants themselves enforce a whole lot of rules about behavior. There are behaviors that are absolutely not tolerated there. You don't urinate in the elevators, you don't draw on the walls, you do clean your halls when it's your turn. You don't, I mean, there's a whole lot of rules and they're very strictly enforced, but it's not outsiders coming in and enforcing those rules. And I would bet, I don't know, I would really like to know what's going on there about teenage pregnancy. I know they've set up a daycare center. I know they've insisted that the people who work in the daycare center be people who live in the project. They've done a whole lot of training, so they've created jobs there. They've created a whole series of businesses connected to that.
Has anyone written it up or gone
yeah,
there?
It has been written up. What's a number of places. And Bertha Gilkey is an extremely powerful person herself. But that's another whole model that's much more rooted in communities. And it has accountability built in. It has a lot of things that we not knowing how to think about.
There's a friend of mine here in Morningside Gardens who did a project from the tenants of Morningside Gardens to set up a committee that deals with health and the care of the aged in the community so they can stay in the houses.
Mm-hmm.
And they got a grant. She wrote the grant, they got a grant. They got a grant to pay for social work as well as the services. The community furnishes the services within the housing project. So there are ways of doing this within these kinds of, you know, organizations, but in fact, she's very experienced now that she's done it. And we were talking last night, but there are some of these people, if you want it done, sometimes you have to do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not as widespread. They know how to link this up so that people know about it having been done in one place. Mm-hmm.
How they get the Sarah? What about the funding for this? Where did some of the money come from?
She's so brilliant. Well, in the first place, they got this is public housing, right? They essentially got the administration of that public housing turned over to the tenants, and they have a tenant council now. I think most public housing didn't was run by tenants, and there's a structure for that. But they also they got UDAG money. They've built a lot more units since they got money to renovate. They've been out, they got money out of the Republicans when nobody else was getting it.
But you said they also have economic development projects.
Yes, they have a food service. They cook the food that is served in the daycare center and in the, there's a senior citizens, one of the buildings, the senior citizens, they cook the food that's served the Meals on Wheels stuff and serve it, and that so that's a business inside. They provide their own security, although I think they've made a rule now that the tenants, the security people, don't work in the project where they live.
Mm-hmm.
But
the one important thing that they don't have to contend with is that middle thing of people who are licensed, the social workers.
Yes.
So whereas in a social agency, the reason I laughed a little bit when you said how do we get our hands on that money is you don't, because by law, it has to go to people who are licensed for it, which is this whole sort of elaborate structure of people with MSWs and CSWs and so many years of experience in Cottage government and that sort of thing. So that's what makes the social services difficult to penetrate.
Except that the welfare department in New York City is not staffed by social workers with degrees. It's staffed by people who pay this minimum.
But the money is still licensed, and the money still goes to people who are credentialed. There's a whole credentialing system.
You mean the people in the welfare department in New York that do the client outreach have to be licensed?
I don't think
no, they take an exam. They take an exam.
Right.
The welfare department job, it's a civil service exam. And once
but
you take that exam,
the people, I see. The people who are their bosses.
No?
The top level.
Yeah, the top level. Right. But then again, when they make the psychiatrist who was discharged over the other Bumpus case, was one was trying to mitigate the ill effects of the system, and they used him particularly as a scapegoat at the time. But he was trying to get through the bureaucracy to protect this woman and his diagnosis, so that even depends who you recruit, they came down on him, and he had
to. The system is really there to protect itself. It's not there to help you. You never go to the social services if you want help. Because
that's
the
right.
Soon as you get into the system, you are in a police state. I mean, sometimes it's good. You can get help, but there's always a double-edged sword, because you can also...
You have to sue, yeah.
You know, by the time this woman is known to the system, as it's called, she's like, you know, anything she does, forget about putting candles on the floor. Mm-hmm. Look at Mary Beth Whitehead. She didn't say the appropriate thing to Baby M. She's, she said
hooray instead of patty cake.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, that's a very mild version of what constitutes inappropriate behavior to some social workers. So it's very problematic. You can get help, but basically they want to protect the money. There's always a punitive aspect to going to getting help, because they about 40% is providing services, and another 60% of accounting for where the money's going.
That's where the coercion and the blaming.
So really the system, the reason that it's so punitive is to discourage people coming to it. So, I mean, its major function is really to discourage people.
And that's really rooted in the early days of the growth of the concept of public assistance in the 20s and 30s. Like the mode of thinking when this whole idea about helping others that had come out of, in point of fact, the asylum, the history of the asylum,
right.
Which is
yes.
Under what conditions, poor houses and asylums, do you help
right.
others?
Actually, Barbara Nelson has an article that will be out soon, I think, on the gender nature of the welfare state, and she compares mother's aid with workman's compensation. And the difference is that with workman's compensation, you know, you lose a finger, you get $1,000. You lose an eye, you get this. You just fill out the form, you check off the proper body parts, and you get paid. It's not intrusive in the all the programs designed around women in the family are designed to be extremely intrusive.
And control.
25-page question about who last had sex with.
The care for the elderly.
Well, one thing that I think Jeanetta Cole talks about is that even when you're dealing with social services or any kind of anthropology, you're always looking at people who are too poor to protect their own privacy,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have that kind of information about poor people. On rich people, you do with poor people, you can't go in and say, how many phones do you have? How often does this man visit you? How much money does he give you? You were pregnant again, is this by the same man, or is this, you know, and I think a real good representation of this is a film Marsha Mason did, where there's this white prostitute who has a black child, and is also on welfare, and the social worker comes to visit, and doesn't find any milk in the refrigerator, and says, well, there's no milk in the refrigerator. And the mother says, well, kid that won't eat one drink of milk. And, you know, and it's just the kind of interaction that goes on is, and the intrusiveness of it is just really hard to know.
Privacy is a tricky issue, but New York has very stringent privacy laws about what kind of information is available to the public. And yeah, I think what it really does, because you can always get information if you really want to really dig, if you're prepared to go to family court or something and stand around and wait for people to come out. There are lots of ways to find out information about anybody who has anything to do with a public agency. What it really does is protect the agencies themselves, because you cannot get them officially to release records to you.
So in fact, they're not available.
So they're not. They're really not.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that all these confidentiality, and they're very, you know, they're all tied up. They've got computers and supposedly internal bombs that will
destroy
the information if anybody gets into it. And it's all it really is doing is protecting these people who have had cases that they really not done very well. So, I mean, it's not all it's doing, mm-hmm. but it's certainly an important function.
We have a violation of a First Amendment run here. There is one other thing I'd like to I'd like to talk about, because I think it doesn't get said very often, and that is that I think one of the things we're also seeing is, quite apart from much of what we've talked about, I think we're seeing the emergence of a new form of an American family. One in which Karen Lindsay has written a book called Friends as Family, mm-hmm. Beacon Press, a few years ago. And you know, it's this interesting little book, and what she's basically saying is that the valuing of romantic love, the valuing of nurturing and being in nurturing situations, that valuing is still remaining a big constant amongst a lot of people, but that it is now having to confront things like, one, a highly migratory and transitory population. You know, certainly this is more of an issue for the middle class, but it still is an issue for some segments of the working class, where an opportunity for a better job or another situation comes up in another city. You get up and you leave your biological family behind. What do you do in this new place? And she argues that if you really watch some of what you're naturally inclined to do, you will begin to recreate family, but this time it doesn't have blood connections. And it may begin to take on some new and different forms. It may involve, previously at least, non-traditional kinds of relationships. And one that seems to me to be coming to the fore enough for us to look at more seriously is, for me, particularly in the context of the Black family, the growth of situations where even amongst middle-class families or even working-class families, there is a conscious decision to recreate friends and or lovers as family. And at least from my thinking, the people talking about the situation of Black families or white families or green families, they're not talking about that. That seems to be so potentially threatening, and yet it seems all around, it seems right here. It doesn't seem to be something that's only going on in one small pocket in the country. It seems to me glaringly evident in all major cities in which I spend more than a couple of weeks. So in some ways, for whatever set of historical reasons and circumstances, there also seems to be another level of definition or redefinition or recasting of a family. I'm not sure all of what I would attribute it to, but it does seem to be going on.
In fact, it's already affected some of the laws on housing in New York City, so that, you know, it's beginning to filter down this way. Building I live in is co-op, and it's not a very large building, but the number of different household arrangements is so different from when I moved into that building to now. There are single parent households, there's not as much extended family in terms of the ages, mm-hmm. but there is a tremendous amount of variety in what constitutes a household in that building. It has changed, I guess it's really the last 7 years, but really enormous. And all right, given that this is the West Side and there's a middle class kind of here, the consciousness with which this is received, nobody's blinking any eyelashes, you know, it's all very traditional already. conventional is the word rather than traditional.
But it seems there's still this huge gap between what's held up as white middle class American norms and the goodness and rightness and what is the reality.
I mean,
we're talking about it. And it's that norm which causes a great deal of this.
But a lot of the reason, I think, is that it's women who are doing it, and it's a big threat to patriarchal
families. Yeah, I in fact raise this up because I think it's very incumbent upon this generation of feminists to help recast that language in ways that make it perceive, or at least help to have the help towards the perception of it as the normal.
Well, I think the entree was the male gay couple. That was the entree very often in this kind of in these living arrangements, in these households in these neighborhoods that I think they
well,
may
the
have
Upper West Side.
We're talking about forcing illegal changes.
But wherever it's coming from, at least It's gotten the beginnings of recognition.
A footnote, the American Psychological Association is recognizing its insurance plans, alternative lifestyles.
You're kidding. Now, how can they get the insurance companies to go along?
They buy a lot of insurance.
And what's the arrangement they have?
A significant other is insurable.
Wow.
A significant other.
It's a big precedent. Well, okay, I have, I'm willing to go on, but we have 25 of, so maybe they want us, I don't know if they want us to come back together, but. Anything else?
I have this, just a question about the culture of poverty people. Is that based on a Marxist analysis?
No, Oscar Lewis.
Oh, the Oscar Lewis.
Yeah, the Children of Sanchez.
Is that Children of Sanchez?
Yeah, Children of Sanchez. It's essentially this, I mean, but whether it's the Children of Sanchez in Mexico or Brazil or Harlem, the basic argument is that the poor have one thing globally in common, their poverty, which is true, but the inference is that they don't really have separate and autonomous or cultural traditions, that we're not really talking about expressions of values or culture which are separate from economically deterministic variables.
So it's class,
it's very economic determinist. It says they are who they are because they're poor. If you change their economic situation, they will resemble more like the rest of us. The assumption is that once you enter the middle class, that the middle class is essentially right, blended, and differences disappear.
They meant well, at some level.
Well, one of my graduate advisors, who I'm very fond of, used to say, a dime and good intentions will get you a cup of coffee.
And it won't
be bad
anymore.
Thank you.